Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. They've been called outlaw machines because of the image of those who ride them. But how much is myth and how much is reality in what we think we know about the history of Harley-Davidson motorcycles? That's the subject of our interview this week with Brock Yates, author of Outlaw Machine, Harley-Davidson and the Search for the American Soul. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. In 1974, after nearly 2 years of attempts to thwart federal investigations and to conceal hours of taped White House conversations, President Richard Nixon announced that he would resign his office. Nixon was elected president in 1968. He used his office to achieve an unprecedented level of international stability and domestic programming. He inaugurated an era of conciliation between the United States and its Cold War communist enemies, the Soviet Union, and China, and he advanced new civil rights and welfare initiatives at home. Nixon's very public downward spiral began on the evening of June 17, 1972, when a group of loyalists known as the Plumbers broke into the Democratic National Committee's headquarters at the Watergate Hotel. It was a failed attempt to obtain information concerning Democratic strategy against the Nixon re-election campaign. Aside from implicating the president and his closest advisors in numerous illegal activities, the Watergate affair presented the Supreme Court with major constitutional dilemmas. What were the limits of executive privilege as it related to concealing pertinent criminal evidence? And could a sitting president be formally indicted? In the end, the court ruled against Nixon on both issues, and he was compelled to resign. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. These words, first spoken by Thomas Jefferson over 200 years ago, were repeated by Democratic Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut after hearing the disappointing results of a basic American history exam administered to students of some of the nation's most prestigious colleges and universities. Nearly 80% of all telephone respondents receive either a D or F on the test, compelling Lieberman and like-minded lawmakers to introduce legislation that would strengthen American history requirements in institutions of higher learning. Currently, few of even the country's best colleges and universities require such courses. Ultimately, sponsors of this legislation hope that the phrase, "Give me liberty or give me death," will be as familiar to college grads as Beavis and Butthead, pop culture characters that 99% of the respondents could identify. Who says that bank mergers are merely a financial matter? In a recent merger of Wells Fargo and Norwest Bancorp in Nebraska, forgotten historic photographs and documents were found in a vault at the downtown Omaha branch. Many of the documents were authentic land-grant proposals made by the state during its first settlement, donning the signatures of Presidents Buchanan, Lincoln, and Johnson. You're listening to Talking History. Harley-Davidson has been associated with Hell's Angels and the hippie riders of the 60s. Marlon Brando rode one in the movie The Wild One, but so too does comedian Jay Leno. As Eileen Dugan discovered in her interview with Brock Yates, Harley-Davidson is one of the great success stories of American history.
With its unmistakable roar and outlaw image, the Harley-Davidson has become the most legendary of all motorcycles, an American icon. But how did the Harley achieve such a rugged image and lofty status? And why is it the Harley that has come to be so closely associated with the American spirit? Joining us to examine the mystique of the Harley-Davidson is Mr. Brock Yates, one of America's leading automotive journalists and editor-at-large for Car and Driver magazine. He is the author of the recent book, Outlaw Machine, Harley-Davidson, and the Search for the American Soul. Welcome, Mr. Yates.
Good morning.
How did the Harley-Davidson get this bad boy image to begin with?
Well, it's a kind of a long and involved story. Of course, motorcycles have always had kind of an edgy image ever since the beginning when they were at first perceived as kind of utilitarian, and they were going to kind of be a two-wheeled alternative to the automobile. But very, very shortly thereafter, they became sporting machines, and were attracted adventurous, kind of wild young men. So they were sort of out there right from the beginning, image-wise.
And there was a particular incident in Hollister, California, that really sealed the Harley fate in particular as an outlaw machine.
That was, on the 4th of July, 1947, a little town of Hollister, California, had what turned out to be a relatively small riot. Probably 200 or 300 World War II veterans rode into town on motorcycles. There was a weekend of a kind of a rally for a lot of motorcyclists that showed up, but a very tiny percentage of them got involved in what was a mini riot on their main street. And this led to a couple of years later to a short story in Harper's Magazine that was based on the riot, and that in turn led to The Wild One, the movie with Marlon Brando and Lee Marvin. That was a Stanley Kramer picture that was based on the Harper's short story, which was based on the Hollister situation. So that really solidified the imagery of overall of motorcyclists being this wild rabble that were going to come into your hometown and wreck it. Ironically, Marlon Brando in the picture rode a Triumph motorcycle. Lee Marvin, who's the real bad guy in the picture, did ride a Harley Davidson. No.
Well, that's good. and as I recall, there was a photograph taken at Hollister that helped create this image.
Yeah, really, that was the sort of seminal reason why this happened. It was taken originally for the San Francisco Chronicle, but was reprinted in Life magazine of a guy who we believe was named Eddie Davenport, although he was never identified, sitting on a Harley Davidson, the motorcycle surrounded by empty beer bottles, and this guy looking thoroughly drunk. And the picture was put into Life magazine, and that in its own way was the quintessential moment when Harley Davidson was identified as quote, an outlaw machine. That picture, and again, that picture was pivotal in creating the image of motorcyclists being well guys.
Now, you mentioned that in the Hollister incident, many of the participants were World War II veterans. Why did they gravitate towards the Harley?
Well, I'm not sure that they did at that point. Harley Davidson was one of many motorcycles that were ridden into Hollister, but what happened was in 1954, Indian, which was the only other really domestically built motorcycle, went out of business. It left Harley Davidson as the sort of only domestically built motorcycle. There was a kind of air of patriotism about owning imported machinery of any kind at that time. And so the Harley-Davidson kind of won by default. It also had, as we know, this very, very kind of guttural rumble of the exhaust, and it's very, its elemental sound and imagery was very important to the rise of the motorcycle clubs known publicly as gangs. And that all came together in the early 1950s.
And you talk about the origins, for example, of the Hells Angels, the most famous, of course, of the motorcycle clubs. How did they originate?
Well, there were a lot of clubs that existed prior to World War One or World War Two that were relatively benign and kind of touring motorcycle clubs. And after the war, there were an awful lot of restless and dispossessed veterans that came out of World War II, and they gravitated toward the hot rod movement, toward and also toward motorcycles. and a sense of adventure and kind of outlawry just sort of pervaded those machines. And the there were other clubs that had been started up prior to the Hells Angels. Hells Angels really started up and it became active in 1949, 1950 in the working class towns in Southern California, San Bernardino, and elsewhere. And they were really just a, one of a number of motorcycle clubs that were kind of chugging along, doing their own thing, until Hunter Thompson wrote his wonderful book in 1966 about the Hells Angels, and that that really thrust them into the limelight.
And they have a very bad reputation among for the general public, but how does their reputation actually compare with the reality of the Hells Angels?
Well, they're really interesting people. They are not, contrary to sort of public perception, a bunch of ignorant idiots. They're some very, very bright, intelligent men in that organization. They just operate on the perimeters of society, and obviously they have jumped over the line in a lot of areas, but they are extremely independent, very suspicious of authority. They live against their own very, very firm and strong code, and of course around that is built now the Harley-Davidson motorcycle, which is a very integral part of that culture. In the main, because it's the only American-built motorcycle. I think if there were other American-built motorcycles, they probably would be accepted as well. But there's a lot of kind of chauvinism or patriotism tied around all the clubs, and so Harley-Davidson is part of the deal.
So on the one hand, we have the Hells Angels in the 1950s. We have the Hells Angels who are, and the motorcycle clubs, the older World War II veterans and such, buying the Harleys, but we also have youth gravitating towards these machines as well. Why is that?
I think it's the rebel image. It's the image of power and speed and rebelliousness that naturally is attractive to young people. But the average Harley-Davidson owner is no kid. He's in his 40s and early 50s for the most part, because they're very expensive and they're difficult for a young person to go out and buy, and both for male and female. There is a relatively small percentage, I think maybe 4 or 5% of their market is female, but for the most part it's a male-oriented market of older guys.
How did the corporate men in Milwaukee think about Harley's growing image in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s of Harley as an outlaw machine?
Right. Oh, they hated it. They hated it. They didn't understand it. They were outraged by the idea that, first of all, that people would take these motorcycles and convert them into what were known as choppers, i.e. They'd saw off all the effluvia and all the chrome and all the gadgetry and make a very, very lightweight, lean and mean motorcycle out of what they thought was a perfectly acceptable, big kind of touring bike. And so to a point where Harley-Davidson refused to permit its dealers to even service these motorcycles. They wouldn't sell them parts. I mean, they just hated the whole idea that these motorcycles were representative of a customer base that they didn't want to know about. And they didn't want to know about it really until the late 1970s, when suddenly Willie G. Davidson, who is the grandson of one of the founders and a design genius, began to recognize that this was the heart and soul of the Harley-Davidson, not only of its customer base, but also its image, and began to court those outlaws, in quotes, but at least the people that rode these motorcycles outside the accepted perimeters of Harley-Davidson marketing philosophy.
In a way, the transformation of Willie G. from a gray flannel suit corporate man to the god of Harley is an interesting comment upon the evolution of Harley-Davidson as a company, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, he almost is a paradigm for the whole transformation of the company. And he did lead the company in many, many ways toward a recognition that if they were going to be they're going to be successful, they had to be inclusive of this sort of raffish outlaw rebelliousness that outlaw image that that motorcycle represented to the general public. So he was leading edge as far as that was concerned.
A popular image that we have just in the American mentality is that of the hippie biker, of bikers being hippies as well. But you talk about how these movements really didn't get along all that well in the 1960s.
No, they didn't. It was that was a manifestation of Roger Corman and other B-movie directors developed the idea that they were much the same, but they weren't. In fact, I talk about in the book how there was a very brief romance between the hippies and the Hells Angels, as interestingly enough, both Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson recount the weekend that they spent it together at Ken Kesey's ranch in Northern California. But that was a very, very brief interlude, and in fact, the Angels were very strongly supportive of the Vietnam War. And it was a moment of a very, very brief contact, and then they went their opposing ways.
And in a sense, the Hells Angels beating up Hunter S. Thompson at the end of, later on, I should say, sort of really sealed that split, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, Hunter never did quite understand what happened, but I think that he recognized later that they were... they felt that they'd been co-opted, that some of the guys in the club felt that he had been poking around simply to write a book about them, and I think they didn't like that, and I think that was the reason for the beating.
And nowadays, of course, we are seeing the rich and famous buying Harleys. The image, of course, of Malcolm Forbes riding around on his Harley and Elizabeth Taylor on her pink machine. I mean, how is it that this outlaw machine suddenly began to appeal to the wealthy?
Well, it's an interesting transformation, but I think it probably involves a whole sort of urge toward away from androgyny and sort of political correctness and a lot of movements that were beginning to prevail in the late 1970s and through the 1980s, and I think it's a reaction, it's an urge toward male expression, if you will, a kind of counterbalance to the sort of feminization of some males, and I think that they feel kind of comfortable, and that it's sort of an attempt to reaffirm their masculinity, I suppose, in a kind of strange way, but it does seem to relate to that. I think there's a kind of very powerful male quality about a motorcycle, and I think that, and I'm not trying to get into pop psychology here, but there is that, and I think it does, I think that's a need and an urge that this motorcycle tends to fulfill for people.
You talk about in your book as well the great competition that Harley began to face in the 1960s with the influx of Japanese motorcycles and how it's managed to survive over the years. We had just a moment left, but with all of its stubbornly antique features, how is it that Harley has managed to survive?
Well, it is an antique, and it represents kind of fundamental verities, I guess, and maybe there's a lot more kind of traditionalism in the American culture than we realize, and I think it does... It there's a solidity and a kind of patina about that machine that it's always there. There's a steady quality about it, and I think it relates a lot to our discomfort with sort of the brave new world.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Yates.
Thank you.
We have been talking to Mr. Brock Yates, editor at large for Car and Driver magazine, and author of the book Outlaw Machine: Harley Davidson and the Search for the American Soul.
That's when I fell for leader of
The history of motorcycles in America is fascinating, but so is the public reaction to them, which is the subject of our op-ed today by Melissa Holbrook Pearson, the author of The Perfect Vehicle, What It Is About Motorcycles.
It should have come as a surprise to no one, and thus it starred as surprising news on front pages everywhere, that motorcycles have finally become suitable furnishings for Frank Lloyd Wright. Two summers ago, a parade of the machines marched in historical formation through the great architect's Guggenheim Museum. Record-breaking numbers viewed the exhibit and bought a few truckloads of whatever biking gewgaws they could get their hands on. But how could this be a shock when we live in an age where yesterday's outrage becomes today's $12.99 special at Target? The outrage was distinctly more raw in the 1950s, that time of conformity and aggressive wound healing. Of course, nice guys, and the increasingly rare gal, took their Indians and Harleys out for a Sunday spin, but it was a certain bad element that was becoming most associated with the motorcycle. The Hell's Angels were formed post-war by ex-servicemen who exemplified the notion of the one percenter, that portion of society that doesn't fit and doesn't care. It was types like these who gathered in Hollister, California in 1947 to exchange bottles and rocks for police tear gas, an episode that 6 years later inspired The Wild One, the Marlon Brando movie that launched a thousand exploitation flicks. The public reveled openly in their revilement of, and secretly in their titillation by, these social dissenters, and the two have been the motorcycle's companions ever since. While the mayhem continued on-screen and, as usual, to a much lesser extent off-screen in the 60s, another change was on the way. Suddenly, you meet the nicest people on a Honda, and you can get closer to nature while letting your freak flag fly from your freedom machine. Every decade, it seems, puts the motorcycle to use in carrying its peculiar banner. Anyone who didn't covet a big family sedan in the 50s was a miscreant. Man, you gotta be a little free, a little wild, come the next 10 years. Money started polishing up the two-wheeler's image in the 80s, and now it is just not possible to be a proper dot-com millionaire without a Ducati in the driveway. I'm not sure what the future holds in any other respect, but as regards the ups and downs of the motorcycle's reputation, I would bet my showy helmet on one thing. The cycles will go on.
You've been listening to Melissa Holbrook Pearson, author of The Perfect Vehicle, What It Is About Motorcycles. And this is Talking History.
Get your motor running.
Head out on the highway.
Looking for adventure.
And whatever comes our way. Yeah, I got no way to get out of my way. Take the world in a loving place.
If the Harley-Davidson is so popular, there must be a museum dedicated to that two-wheel wonder. Here to tell you about such a place is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Dale's Harley-Davidson Wheels Through Time Motorcycle Museum in Mount Vernon, Illinois, is one of the few places in the country where a large volume of privately owned bikes can be viewed by the public at no charge. Each of the motorcycles are displayed with bits of memorabilia, artwork, and literature to help the visitor gain insight into the past behind each bike. In 1914, there were more than 30 motorcycle makes in production in the U.S., and today there are more than 6 million motorcycle enthusiasts in the U.S. alone. Of course, if you can't make it to Illinois, you can always check out the Museum of the American Open Road at Mike's famous Harley-Davidson dealership, parts store, museum, and restaurant in Newcastle, Delaware. Currently on display there, you can see the only Harley-Davidson motorcycle to be ridden around the world.
Thank you, Cindy. And if you prefer visiting a museum a bit further away, we recommend an exhibit at the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. The Art of the Motorcycle examines the 130-year history of that vehicle, including its various models and different production techniques, as well as cultural, sociological, and economic factors that have come into play in its marketing around the world. The exhibit closes on September 3rd, however, so if you're interested, contact the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, soon for more information. Meanwhile, presidential elections are on the horizon. Talking History has some special programming planned for the fall, but until then, we'd like to call to your attention a program scheduled for August 18th on PBS, which will give you some of that history. A Third Choice, part of the PBS's Democracy Project, will examine America's emerging political leadership in light of the country's national experience with third parties and independent candidates. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtime. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a timely look at the history of vacations. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I'm still dreaming. Yeah, it's right between the machine. On the side of the side, I'm listening to nothing.